faces, but only a single circular eye, which glowed in the centre of their foreheads. Daedalus shouted in dismay and gestured for Talus and the automatons to attack, but the machines were more than outmatched. The giants turned their gaze to the bronze clockworks, and a great booming horn sounded, the language of Titans. As the companions watched, the automaton stopped in mid-stride and slowly turned to stone. The giants turned their gaze to the sea, and John counted 7 of them as they moved past the island, stepping over it in a single stride. A few more steps to the east, and they were already over the horizon. In moments, they had disappeared completely.
"Decide, Jack," said Peter. "You cannot return my shadow unless you enter the cave. But you cannot enter the cave without deciding who you really are. And if you cannot, I will die."
Jack was struggling. He had been a child again for too long, and he was uncertain what to do.
"It's no use, Peter," said the woman in the mirror. "He'll never be able to do it. After all," she added scornfully, "he is only a child."
"But that's just it," said Jack. I'm not a child."
The beast children stood back in mixed wonder and fear. Something was happening to the strange boy who'd flown there in the living ship. Having not just thought the thoughts, but actually spoken the words, Jack grew taller, and his features lengthened, thickened. He was becoming older before their very eyes, adding days, weeks, then faster, months. And then months became a year, a terrible thing for a lost boy to contemplate.
"I do know who I am," Jack said. "I'm an Oxford scholar."
1 year, 2 years, 5 years, 10.
"I'm a caretaker of the Imaginarium Geographica."
10 years, and 5 more.
"I know," said Jack, with the surety and confidence of a fully grown man. "I know what needs to be done."
Peter nodded.
"And that, boy, is the difference."
Jack stepped into the cave. Instantly, the second shadow detached itself and flew across the floor, attaching itself to Peter. As Jack watched, the color rose in the old man's cheeks, and his eyes, dull a moment ago, glittered with life. He took a deep breath, then another, and another, and then lifted his head and looked at Jack. He was smiling. Jack motioned to the beast children.
"Come on," he said to them. "This isn't a monster. Let's get him free, ne?"
And the lost boys nodded their heads and did as he asked. Not because he was an adult, who must be obeyed, but because they knew the boy called Jack was still somewhere inside the long beard, and Jack could be trusted.
"Let's get you into the light," said Jack,
"and then let's go rescue your granddaughter." The Piper's shadow screamed in fury, and Daedalus was at a loss. In a single move, all their plans had been turned to dust.
"That's what you call a checkmate," said Charles.
"I'm not defenseless," snarled Daedalus. "I still control Jason's sons, and they're more than a match for any of you."
"No, you don't," said Stephen. "Perhaps you did, but you built them to follow my commands, not yours, and they're not doing anything else you say."
Daedalus trembled with anger, but realized he was beaten. Carefully he began to back toward the red dragon.
"Will! Hugh!" called Stephen. "Stop him!"
The two brothers moved swiftly behind the inventor and picked up several of the stone blocks. Daedalus stopped.
"What are you doing?" he cried. "Put those back!"
Stephen turned to his mother.
"He was condemned to stay forever in the tower where he murdered his nephew," the prince said calmly. "But he figured out a way around that."
"That was the deal I struck with the King of Crickets," said Daedalus. "If I helped him with his crusade, he promised to have the Prince of the Archipelago free me from my imprisonment." "You were willing to sacrifice all these children merely to get out of a just punishment?"
asked Charles.
what kind of monster are you?
I gave them wings, said Daedalus. I did more for these children than they deserved. But I deserve something in return. If some of them paid the price for that, it wasn't my fault.
Stephen walked over to the inventor and looked at him appraisingly. I release you from your bondage, he said, and he reached out a hand and pushed. Daedalus screamed as he fell away from the stones and burst into flame. In seconds there was nothing left of him but ash. Avon looked horrified. Her son had changed in the years he'd been gone. He was no longer under the Piper's control, but the experience had changed him nonetheless. With Daedalus's death, both Hugh and William finally seemed to come to themselves and, realizing they were no longer entirely human, began to weep. The Piper's shadow flitted back and forth above their heads, hissing.
"What do we do about him?"
asked Charles.
"If you don't mind," a voice called from above, "I'd like a word with him myself."
It was Peter. He and Jack were flying above in the Indigo Dragon.
"Now," Peter said to the shadow, "let's finish this, shall we?"
The shadow vibrated with hate as the airship landed and Peter climbed out.
"You're an old man now," it growled. "What harm can you do to me?"
"Why don't you come down here and we'll find out,"
said Peter. But the shadow stayed where it was, hovering just out of reach. Avon looked both nervous and relieved to see Peter, who caught her eye and winked.
"We thought it was Orpheus," John explained, "but it only laughed at us."
"Of course it isn't Orpheus," said Peter. "This Longbeard killed Orpheus and left his head in the cave to taunt me. No, this fellow and I have a long history as enemies."
Peter continued, circling the shadow warily.
"He may be only a shadow now, but I'd know him anywhere. Oh, we've had great battles, he and I. We are old adversaries. He's the original spectre of the archipelago. He's the Sinner King. He's the Hook. But of all his names, you may know him best as Mordred."
"Mordred?" John exclaimed.
The shadow circled them. It seemed to know it had been named, and in the naming, it had lost most of its power over them.
"You have nothing that can harm me," Mordred said to Peter. "I cannot be defeated."
"I have what you lack," said Peter. "I still have my body."
The shadow growled and suddenly lunged at the old man. But Peter was prepared for the attack and reached into his tunic. He flung a handful of glittering dust at the apparition, and with a scream that rent the air, the shadow spread out, then vanished, leaving only the ringing echo of its cry.
"Is it gone?" said Jack. "Did you kill him, Peter?"
"I doubt it," Peter replied. "That was powdered silver, fairy dust. It's enough to dissipate him for a time. But I don't think it can destroy him. After all," he added, winking at Jack, "a shadow is a pretty sturdy thing if you treat it right. But it is still just that, a shadow. That's why he could never enter the cave. In Plato's cave, all shadows are cast by real things. But a shadow cannot cast itself. He couldn't enter the cave without revealing who he really was."
"Oh, no!" John exclaimed. "Look!"
While Peter and the companions had been occupied with Mordred's shadow, Burton and the Croatones had quietly commandeered and lifted off in the Indigo Dragon.
"Farewell, caretakers,"
Burton called out from the aft deck. "And thank you."
"Well, I'll be damned," said Bert. "That's almost as surprising as Mordred."
"I'm sorry," said Charles. "One of us should have been watching her."
"It's all right," Bert reassured him. "Burton won't damage her. He knows her value. And besides, we have all the other dragon ships now. For the first time since they were created, all of them are together. and all the children have been saved. All in all, I don't think we could have asked for a better ending to this adventure.
Maybe you spoke too soon, said John, pointing over the beach. The time storm had continued to boil, and one more patch of air was shimmering. Something was coming through.
Father! Cried William the pig. It's Father!
Christ above, said John. I think that's Jason. From the portal of time, a group of weary-looking wanderers, dressed in ancient Greek attire, walked slowly across the sand. The leader wore a haggard expression, and his face was deeply creased, more with living than with age. They approached the companions, ignoring the throngs of children who were watching their passage.
"We seek two boys," Jason said to John. "My sons. Have you seen them?"
"Father, please," said William the pig. "We are here. We are right here in front of you."
Hugh the Iron began to sob.
"Will, it's no use. I don't think he knows we're here."
The shade of Jason made no indication that he heard or saw his sons, but merely turned away from John and stared out across the waters, his face racked with sadness and loss.
"He can't see them," John said softly. "He can't see them at all."
The ghostly procession passed around them, even through them, a parade of spirit that hardly acknowledged them, if indeed they even knew anyone was there. William and Hugh fell to the sand in sorrow and grief, and after a few more moments, Jason and the others who followed him walked past the companions and vanished back into time, still searching for Jason's lost sons.
"This is what Dante was warning mankind of in his writings," mused Bert. "He said that the hottest places in hell are reserved for those who, in time of great moral crises, maintain their neutrality. I think what we just witnessed happening with Jason is precisely that."
"Remember Milton's caution also,"
Charles whispered.
"The mind is its own place, and in itself can make a heaven of hell and a hell of heaven."
Chapter 24. Second Star to the Right. It was an organizational nightmare, but within a day, the companions were able to get all the children aboard the seven dragon ships for the journey home. They had planned to go directly to Haven, but William and Hugh made a curious request, which Peter and the caretakers chose to grant, and so their first stop was Aiea. They moored all the ships and accompanied William and Hugh to the labyrinth, where John explained to Asterius that the brothers had requested to live there with him in the Abbey of the Rose. For his part, the odd creature protested mightily, but the broad smile on his face told them that he was very pleased to accommodate their request.
"They didn't want to come back to Haven," Peter explained to the companions. "They felt they were deformed. I tried to convince them otherwise, but they wished for this, and actually, they may find their calling here."
"Interesting children you've chosen to succeed you, Herb," Peter said when they returned to the ships. "Especially that one, John."
"He has the talent to make connections where none are evident, Peter," said Bert. "He has the rarest of abilities, to retain a practical head about him without losing the ability to imagine. He's really quite extraordinary. Do you know that as a child he invented his own languages, and more? He invented etymologies and histories and even mythologies to accompany them."
"Impressive," Peter commented, scratching himself. "His histories will make for interesting reading."
"Oh, I don't think that's John's path," said Bert. "He's not built to write straight accounts, as Bacon did, or even to really fictionalize his adventures the way Jamie and I have. No, John's an inventor, pure and simple. It's what first attracted Stellan's attention. John has within himself entire realities that he's going to create and share with the world. And to be honest, I think his legacy is going to eclipse us all."
"See," said Peter, "that's the advantage of having never learned to write.
I don't have to worry about things like legacies.
Ah, Bert said. This from the Great Pan? Your legacy is already carved in stone.
He paused.
Actually, he added, reconsidering, it's in bronze, in Kensington Gardens.
Yes, said Peter. I've seen it. It's awful. Makes me look like a prat. I told Jamie that if they were going to put up a statue, it should at least be one of the ones that pees on people.
Bert chuckled.
Like the one in Bruxelles?
Who, Christoph? Said Peter. He isn't a statue. At least, he didn't start out as one. He was one of the first lost boys who learned a valuable lesson from Medea. Don't piss on a witch's front door.
On Haven, with a sense of responsibility and no small regret, the caretakers claimed the histories that had for so long been part of Daedalus's collection in his workshop.
He did do a lot of good things over the centuries, said Peter, as he passed through to check on their progress. If nothing else, try to think well of him for that. He's a very forgiving sort, isn't he? Said Charles. I don't know that I could have felt the same way about someone who'd betrayed me so greatly, if I were in his position.
I think I understand why, John said. I've been reading in the other histories, and I've come across a story that explains a great deal about the Pan. You both know the story, and quite well. We just never knew the full extent of it until now. There was an old tale about a European village that was overrun with rats. The village elders held a meeting to decide what to do, and a stranger stood up and declared that he could lead the rats away to the river to be drowned by playing a tune on his magic pipes. The town agreed to pay whatever price he named if he could indeed do this thing, and so that very night he did. He told the villagers to shut their doors and windows tightly, and to stuff rags in the cracks and crevices, so that they could not hear the tune he played. And sometime in the night he performed his task, for when they awoke the next morning, all the rats were gone.
I know this tale, said Charles. The Pied Piper of Hamelin. Jacob and Wilhelm Grimm wrote the story in one of their books. As it went, Hamelin refused to pay the piper's fee, and so the next night he played a tune that entranced the children in the same way he did the rats. But instead of leading them to the river to drown, he led them to the sheer face of a mountain, which split open to receive them, and they were never seen again.
Jacob learned of it from travellers in the Archipelago of Dreams, said Bert, although I'm certain he never came here to the underneath, or else he'd have learned the truth of it.
The children were seen again, John continued, just not in Europe. They were brought here, to the underneath, where they were sorted out by Mordred, posing as the piper.
The time storm, said Bert. He was using the openings in time, caused by the crumbling keep, to cross back and forth in history and recruit his soldiers.
Wasn't there one child who was unable to follow? Put in Jack. One who was lame and couldn't reach the opening in the mountain quickly enough.
Exactly so, said John. That boy, who had a crippled leg, was tormented by the enchanted melody that in all of Hamelin Town only he remembered.
And he mourned the loss of his friends and saw the anguish of their parents, and he determined to do something. He decided that he would find them and bring them home.
And did he succeed? Charles asked.
In part, said John. After many years of searching, he finally found the lost children. But he never returned home. Instead, he became lost himself. The caretakers went to look for Peter, to say goodbye before leaving for the archipelago. They found him with Laura Glue in Raleigh's orchard near Echo's Well.
"You'll be able to cross back into the archipelago with the dragon ships," said Peter. "It's part of their nature to cross magical barriers. They needn't be able to fly, although we won't tell Burton that," he added with a wink at Laura Glue.
"And what of you, Peter?" asked John. "What do you plan to do?"
"Why, what I'm already doing," he answered.
Peter walked past them and looked into the well. It reflected back the aged lines of his face, the white shock of hair. But it didn't change.
"Ollie, Ollie, oxen free," he called, grinning.
Nothing about his appearance changed.
"See," he said to John, "I didn't change because I found who I really was, who I really am, who I want to remain. I'm Laura Glue's grandfather."
"I suppose if you ever wanted to retire as the Pan, you could just choose a successor," said Charles. "Not that you need to, of course,"
he added hastily.
"But I did choose a successor," said Peter. "A child of the right temperament and age who, if he had chosen differently, might have come to the Netherland and remained a child."
"How can you decide if a child has the right kind of temperament?" asked John. Peter grinned puckishly.
"Because if he didn't, he wouldn't have been able to become one here," he said, looking at Jack.
"Me?" Jack said in surprise. "When did you ever choose me?"
"Long ago," said Peter. "I came to you in the night and listened to your dreams. And then I whispered stories to you about the Netherland, where you could become whoever you wanted, and even take a new name. Jack, Jaxy, Jack in the Green. Why do you think you were the one who was able to share my shadow, if not because we are the same, you and I?"
Jack went pale.
"It was you," he whispered. "You're the one who called me Jack."
But Peter only winked, and spryly moved away to play with the children, his limp barely noticeable. "It's never fully healed," John observed. It was Peter who inspired Daedalus to resume his old experiments in flight. He wanted Peter to be able to move about freely in the air, since he could not do so on land. It may have been the single most redeeming thing the inventor ever did.
"The child in Hamelin,"
Charles exclaimed.
"The one who went searching for his friends. It was Peter, wasn't it?"
"Yes," John nodded. "I believe it was. I don't know who he truly was before he came here, but once here, he became Peter Pan, and he always will be, forevermore." As they said their goodbyes to Peter, a tearful Laura Glue and the rest of the Lost Boys, Peter had one parting gift for them, if it could truly be called a gift. It was the padlocked wardrobe, the only thing he'd chosen to remove from Plato's cave, where it had been kept ever since his falling out with Jamie.
"We know how to make and repair Daedalus's wings," Peter said, "and we have plenty of dragon feathers with which to make more, so we don't really have to have this. And besides," he added, "I don't really feel the need to go to London that much any more."
He embraced his granddaughter and thumped the wardrobe.
"Find a good place for it, won't you?"
"Well, gosh," Artus exclaimed, "what a handsome wardrobe."
They placed it in the great Watsit. There wasn't a better place for it in the entire archipelago, John decided. The reunion with Stephen and Avon made Artus happier than they'd ever seen him, and he declared that there should be a celebration across the entire archipelago. Avon and Stephen left to make preparations, and the king was left with the caretakers, who told him everything that had happened. When they were finished, Artus sat back and looked pointedly at each of them.
"I know you want to ask it, so ask."
"All right," said John, rising. "Where are the dragons?" Artus nodded.
"I knew it would come up sooner or later, but I was rather hoping for later. I sent them away, back to where they'd come from, past the edge of the world, beyond Terminus."
"Why?" asked John. "They have always been the strength of the Silver Throne."
"Yes," said Artus. "And that's what troubled me. I did not want to depend on brute force in order to rule. And I'd already decided that a monarchy may not be the best way to run an entire archipelago. But if there were no king who was able to manage the dragons, it would be even more unwieldy to expect a parliament to do it. So I decided, and as of today, my work is clear.
before another year has passed in the archipelago, I will have begun the dissolution of the monarchy. When the others had left, Jack hung back to speak with the king in private.
Artus, I have something to ask, said Jack. Something very personal, I'm afraid.
Artus nodded as if he'd been expecting the question.
You've been wondering about Avon and our son.
Yes.
He's a good boy, Artus said.
I couldn't be prouder if he were my own flesh and blood.
Then he isn't? Isn't yours and Avon's?
I know you have eyes, Artus replied. I have hair like straw, and I'm so fair-skinned, when I'm out in the sun too long, the freckles on my arms turn green. He has his mother's eyes and cheekbones, but he gets his handsome complexion from his father.
The pieces fell into place.
That's how your son can be nearly 9 years old, even though it's only just been 9 years since you met his mother, Jack guessed.
Yes, said Artus. Avon and Nemo had been closer than she admitted to anyone, and even he wasn't really able to convince her to settle down. She was, is, happiest on the seas, piloting a ship. So when I asked her to marry me, she said yes, but then I backed down after I saw how unhappy she'd become. She'd agreed at first in order to help me become accustomed to running a kingdom, and I thought she wanted it because of the pending birth of her son. But as it turned out, neither one of us needed a marriage for the reasons we thought we did, so we didn't.
And yet, Jack went on, you call Stephen your son and have raised him as such.
At this, Artus looked taken aback.
Of course. Why wouldn't I? There's a lot more to being a father than whether or not I'm the one who started the process. It's seeing it through that counts.
That's very admirable, said Jack. I don't know if I'm capable of that, raising another man's child as if he were my own. I don't know if I have the strength of character for it.
Stephen is Avon's son, said Artus. That was enough for me. She knows I love her, and our arrangement, while it might be a bit strange to some people, works for us. And isn't that what matters?
It isn't for me to judge, Jack replied. I've sometimes wondered if I'll ever get married at all. I watch John and Charles, and at times I envy them, but I can still relate. How you've done what you're doing is just beyond my understanding.
Artus clapped him on the back.
I'm sure if the situation arises, he said, you'll be able to find the joy in it, as I have. And if you ever need advice, you know where to come to.
Avon and Stephen looked up from the table in the hall and waved. Jack and Artus waved back.
Kids, said Artus. They grow up so fast. It seems like just yesterday he was only 9.
It was last week, actually.
That's just as bad, said Artus.
The celebrations in the archipelago lasted for a full day and a full night, as the peoples of all the lands came to Parallon to reclaim their lost children. Still, all the happiness over, the successful return of the children couldn't mitigate the frustration the caretakers felt over the dilemmas that would still have to be dealt with in the near future. The Indigo Dragon was still in the possession of Burton and the Croatoan Indians. The Keep of Time was still crumbling and would continue to do so, and there could be rogue caretakers back in their world who were actually working for the Imperial Cartological Society. Basically, Charles declared, the entire adventure was still a catastrophe.
Not a catastrophe, said John, more a eucatastrophe, I think. It was all grim and terrible to a point, but things seemed to have worked out in the end.
Jack, said Charles, he's making up words again.
Yes, Jack replied, but he's getting better at it, don't you think?
You're forgetting the most frightening loose ends of all, said Bert. Our great adversary still exists. Your shadow may be separated from you, may be captured or imprisoned, or twisted and manipulated, but it cannot exist without you.
Cannot exist, said John. As in, your shadow will not outlast your death?
Correct, said Bert. And if that truly was Mordred's shadow we faced, then our old adversary, the Winter King, is still alive.
It was time to return home. There were matters there that needed tending to, and the companions felt that for the moment they had done enough. "After you," John said to Jack. Jack looked at Charles, who also nodded that he should be first, and with a last smile at Bert, Jack stepped into the wardrobe. One by one, they pressed the furs aside and emerged from the wardrobe onto the fourth floor of the townhouse near Kensington Gardens. First Jack, then Charles, and finally John. They were greeted by a beaming figure holding a tray.
"Welcome back," said Jamie. "Have me tea."
Epilogue. On an enchanted island at the frontier of the archipelago of dreams, a cave stood empty. Where once there had been weavers and a loom, only dust remained. And where a great tapestry that was as big as the world had once covered the walls of the cave, there was only a cobweb woven by a spider that had only that day taken up residence in the cave. 700 years earlier, or just yesterday, Roger Bacon, the caretaker principia of the Imaginarium Geographica, pulled his cloak tighter to ward off the chill draughts that passed through his small alcove. The only light came from the tallow candles mounted upon his table, and there were no sounds save for the ticking of the timepiece he'd been given, a gift from the Frenchman. Bacon carefully dipped his pen into the inkwell and continued writing the histories to which he had devoted a considerable part of his life.
"In the year 1212, a boy named Stephen, who claimed to be directed by heaven itself, called upon the sons of Adam and daughters of Eve to rally around him in a great crusade against the infidels and heretics in the East. 30,000 children chose to follow him, and together they boarded 7 great ships, and were never seen again in the world beyond. But they were not lost. Stephen brought them to the archipelago, where he joined with the great Shadow and the sons of Jason, and together they began a great war that devastated all the lands that are."
As he wrote these words, the ticking suddenly stopped, and the wind was stilled. Then, as he watched, the words on the page began to shift and change, and suddenly he could not remember writing what had been there before, but only what appeared there now, in ink still glistening.
30,000 children chose to follow him, and together they boarded 7 great ships, and were never seen again in the world beyond. But they were not lost. Stephen brought them to the archipelago, where he and his master, the great Shadow, were defeated by the bravery and wisdom of 3 scholars and the power of a mother's love. But the great Shadow escaped, and the ships vanished with him into time's embrace. And the great war that was to be waged in the archipelago may yet take place far in the future, in a conflict referred to by the Frenchman called Verne as the 2nd Great War of the World."
And as he closed the book, the ticking began again, and the breeze, warm now, flowed around him, even as time itself continued to ripple and shudder around the old scribe.
The Search for the Red Dragon was written by James A. Owen and read by James Langton. The recording engineer was Michael Jones. Editing and post-production by Frog Pond Productions. Mixed by Hudson Sound. The associate producer was Amory Klimchak. The Search for the Red Dragon was produced and directed by Karen Perlman. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.